May it please the court, counsel, Dan Hansmeyer on behalf of the appellant, Charles Goodwin. Believe it or not, this was supposed to be a single issue appeal, preserving the non-delegation issue, turned into something more. The first two issues I'm going to really discuss. The first one, obviously this court disagrees with us, so we just preserve it and we'll see what the Supreme Court wants to do with it, if anything. On the second issue, the parties agree that there was a reversible plain error with respect to the supervised release advisory guidelines range, and that the case needs to go back on that basis. Third issue.
And the district court actually makes it really clear this is an error by saying that the lifetime supervised release is within the guidelines,
right,
when it isn't.
I think that's true.
Yeah, okay.
The third issue is a little complicated at this point. We challenged four conditions, special conditions of supervised release. Three of those conditions sort of relate to...
So these are the conditions the government doesn't concede are improper?
Well, right. The government concedes that three of the four conditions should be vacated.
That's 4, 6, and 7, right? 5 is
yes,
the one
yes.
about actual contact with minors.
Yes, that's correct.
Is that the one that you disagree with the government about?
Well, yes, we do. But we also disagree with the remedy, I think, on all of it. I think the remedy that we ask for is that the conditions be vacated as, well, on three bases.
But can I just kind of cut through? Because it seems to me the essence of your argument is that the district court judge imposes, I'll just say 4, 6, and 7. I want to put 5 to one side. Conditions that are all internet-related when actually neither the crime of conviction, the SORNA crime, nor even the underlying crime that gave rise to the obligation to register under SORNA had anything to do with the internet. And so why one is restricting this guy's internet access at a minimum was not justified, and maybe at a maximum you've argued that it even, I think it's really more constitutional avoidance, but it bumps into his free expression interests, right?
That is absolutely correct.
Yeah. So taking these three conditions, I think the only difference between you and the government really is remedy and the question whether there should be a remand for some opportunity for the government to show why these internet-related restrictions might be appropriate for the SORNA violation.
I would agree with that.
So why not a remand? What would be the harm? It seems like if you stress the conditions of supervised release have to have something to do with the underlying offense, and as I said, at both levels, it certainly has nothing to do with SORNA. This man has a very bad record, by the way, on SORNA and comparable things. But I could imagine in terms of supervised release that might address that point, you know, more frequent reporting or, you know, something. But filtering software on his computer, unannounced investigations of it, not possessing anything. I was looking at how broad this is and figured that meant that he actually can never turn his television on because most TV is internet streaming these days. And you really can't watch it for 5 minutes without something that's in the scope of this definition. Same with 7. But maybe, you know, with the right guidance, the district court could consider whether any of those kinds of restrictions were nonetheless appropriate.
I think our concern is with the overbreadth of the conditions. And I think
Very overbroad. I agree with you on that.
And I think the government could have come to this court and said the conditions are overbroad. We ask for a remand to consider crafting some sort of conditions, appropriate conditions. They didn't do that. The government has asked
I thought that was what they were talking about, other than...
Conditions should be vacated and remanded for the district court to explicitly address why they are necessary in this particular case. So I essentially read the government as saying there are no First Amendment overbreath concerns. The government, the district court, we're going to ask the government to impose the same conditions on remand, and we hope that he justifies them. So I think the difference between me and the government is that my position is that the conditions cannot be imposed, and the government seems to think that all that needs to happen is that the district court just needs to justify them. So there's
Let's focus on condition five for a moment, because it seems to me there are two ways one could go. Now, his underlying offense, even as he pleads to it, involves a direct contact with a minor.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to adopt the kind of limiting interpretation that some other courts of appeals have adopted and say, you know, this doesn't mean that you can't go to the grocery store because people take their children with them to the grocery store, but it does mean a more immediate kind of interaction. Wouldn't that be enough to satisfy your concerns? Because this guy does look like he needs, you know, or a district court could rationally decide that he might need some supervision around minors.
Correct. My main concern with Condition 5 is the incidental contact and that sort of...
So if that were overbreath. Addressed, right. If that were understood to be an unspoken part of what the district court did, you would be satisfied?
I would be much more likely to be satisfied.
Okay.
Yes.
That's fine. But,
I don't know. There is another portion of Condition 4 where the court authorizes suspicionless searches and seizures of his computer equipment. We've objected to that as well, and that is sort of debatable, I guess. The government says that's okay. Real quickly, my position is that the statute says the search has to be based on reasonable suspicion. So if the court is going to read the suspicion requirement out of the statute, it has to give a reason for it, which it didn't do in this case. And that's especially true with the seizure aspect of it, because the statute doesn't even use the word seizure, just discusses search. So I think if you're going to look at what Congress has authorized, it hasn't authorized this, so there needs to be some justification for it, and I don't see it in the record. And so that's our position as to the search and seizure.
I'm surprised you haven't made an ineffective assistance argument.
Well, he's from my office, Your Honor, so.
Pardon?
The attorney, I work with him. So that would be kind of awkward.
That sounds like a conflict of interest.
No.
Because it's very odd that he didn't object to the... Not only that, but... Did the lawyer even see the probation service's recommendations?
Well, that's another issue in this case, is that our probation office they don't put supervised release in the PSR. It's not
right,
in there.
So the judge sprang it on...
Well, there's an issue as to some sort of letter apparently is sent that's not in the record that says that these conditions might be imposed... But it's not in the PSR, so I guess the attorney didn't object because it's not in the PSR. You have no obligation to object. I don't think to a letter. So that's sort of...
I don't know about that obligation. I'm bothered by that also.
Okay.
That garbled criminal rule, when you exceptions and objections...
Right.
Because, okay, you're a lawyer, you're standing there, and all of a sudden the judge reels off these crazy conditions. I don't think you can just say, well, it wasn't a PSR report, so I don't have to object, I can just appeal. I don't get that. Seems to me, at the least you say to the judge, you know, like I'm really surprised about these conditions, and I'd like an opportunity to, you know, study them. I mean, you've just... stated them orally. I'd like to see them on a piece of paper and, you know, perhaps make objections. I think that would be a minimal obligation of a defense lawyer.
I'd
just say, I'm going to appeal.
Yeah, I would have
put it in the PSR.
I would disagree in Judge Mills's courtroom. for Juan. I do not think he would. When he's done with something, he likes to be done with something.
Very judge specific.
But again, and then it comes back to Rule 51, and our position is that that would be an exception at that point, and there would be no requirement.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Hansmeier. Ms. Mullen.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Hopefully I can even further simplify the issues that we have before us today. And in fairness to Mr. Hansmeier, I think that there are a few places in our brief where I inartfully state what we're asking for here. We would not support the three conditions that we confess error on remand. That's not what I was suggesting. What I was suggesting is that we need to give the district court another bite at the apple because there was no objection below. And the district court might be able to fashion something much narrower that would be grounded in the record in this case
appropriate. I understand that as a hypothetical, but I'm quite disturbed that just because this man has a SORNA obligation, SORNA has a very broad net. And the sort of knee-jerk reaction, SORNA equals computer abuse, equals conditions of supervised release related to computers, I think should be squelched. Not all things that yield a SORNA registration requirement have things to do with computers.
Yes, point well taken. And in this case was a very good illustration of that, isn't it? Because we don't have anything in the record that connects this particular defendant to a computer. We have nothing in the record that suggests.
We don't even know if he has a computer. Right. And I think of, you know, modern life, you know, whether you're trying to deal with the IRS or whether you're trying to deal with something, modern life has made the computer practically like your telephone. And actually, most people's phones are computers. But it's not something that we should. I think one of the messages here is that supervised release conditions have to have something to do with the offense that you're being sentenced for. And this is a registration offense. Maybe if the 20-year-old sex offense had something to do with computers, there might have been some reason to say something. But in this case, it didn't,
We couldn't agree with you more.
So why not just tell the district court, we don't see the link to computers, period.
Right. And I think that one good thing that might come out of this appeal, you know, as I took on the appeal, I was not familiar with these sorts of special conditions and started asking our prosecutors who prosecute these cases, why are we seeing these? Why is, you know, why was this letter sent out with, and why is the judge being told by probation that these are good conditions in these cases? And I think that what I found out through talking to people in our office is that there might be a little bit of sleepwalking going on here, that the probation is offering these up as sort of a one-size-fits-all, or at least was doing that.
So these are showing up in a lot of the J&Cs?
Yes, they are.
And what's this letter process? Does the letter come from the probation office?
I'm glad you asked that. What happens is probation advises the district court separately, these are the conditions that I'm recommending. At the same time, probation sends a letter to the defendant, the defense attorney, and our office saying these conditions might be imposed by the district court. The district court then typically reads off those same conditions.
Why doesn't the probation service put it in the
PSR? It should be put in the PSR.
You better speak to those people. Look at this provision. In 6, you shall neither possess, etc., any material that depicts or alludes to sexual activity. Alludes to sexual activity?
Well, and how about that?
You can't walk down the street.
Right. These are grossly overbroad.
Son, after a stairmaster.
Well, who's in charge of the probation office?
I would even make the argument, Your Honor, that you know, this condition that talks about sexually arousing
also,
material is possible.
I don't understand 8. You shall participate in a sex offender treatment program. Well, does this mean this is a treatment for people who violate SORNA? That they say to you, look, you have a problem. You don't register. we have a special treatment program for people who don't register. Is that what it's
called? Well, no, I think that under the case law, Your Honor, that when fashioning conditions of supervised release, when the court is doing that, it can look to the underlying offense for the SORNA violation. So the court wouldn't be imposing that because someone failed to register, but because of the seriousness of the underlying offense.
But then it's no better than 4, 6, and 7.
Well, I think the problem with 4, 6, and 7 is that we don't have any – there's nothing in this record that would support those particular conditions. We don't have anything –
Well, what would support 8? You mean the fact – I think that he was a sex offender many years – but I see. Because 8 isn't tied to computers.
Right.
You think that's all
right? That's right. But again, I think that this case is a perfect illustration of the fact that everybody needs to wake up a little bit.
Now,
and we need to look at these.
Now, he committed the sexual offense when?
It was about 20 years ago.
91, 92. Yeah. 91, I think. Mm-hmm. He gets tried in 92.
He's an interesting defendant, too, because a lot of times with these sex offense cases, we see a pattern, right? Or when we have the child pornography cases, we have offense after offense. And he's got this sort of modeled criminal history where he's got a cocaine offense and an aggravated battery on his girlfriend, and then we've got the one sex offense. So it's an odd kind of criminal history, and it's atypical, I guess I would say.
And remind me, how long was his sentence?
27 months for the SORNA violation.
No, but his sentence for the underlying sex crime winds up 3 months community confinement, some sort of very light tap on the wrist.
Yeah, well, obviously all the parties need to recommit to focusing on these sorts of conditions, to carefully tailoring conditions, not just because somebody has a
sex offender treatment program. Sounds like a real waste of the taxpayers' money.
Well, I you know, that may be, but you know, we also have.
And what about the issue that Judge Wood raised? You shall have no contact with any person under the age of 18. What does that mean?
Well, again, courts have interpreted that, as Judge Wood pointed out earlier, as not applying to incidental contact but purposeful contact with minors.
The probation service, you explain that rather than leaving it to courts to spell out their. Anyway, what is this purposeful contact stuff?
I think
what
that
if you buy. What if you go shopping and the. And the person with the cash register is under 18.
Judge Posner, I process it this way. If a person, I was thinking about Burger King, a person goes, most of those folks at the cash register are minors. If a person with this kind of condition goes into Burger King and orders a burger and fries and the person happens to be a minor, that I would consider to be incidental conduct.
If they walk up to a little table in front of the local grocery store where the local Girl Scout troop is selling thin mints. Does that mean he can't buy the thin mints?
Well, if I could just go back to my example for a second, Judge Wood. If that same defendant is going back to the same Burger King over and over again, attempting to have contact with a particular cashier, I would consider that to be purposeful. And I think that there's we have to look at this with a little bit of common sense. That's what they're trying to capture in these things. But, you know, it needs to be broad enough to cover the situation that was represented in the underlying offense here, which is the defendant's, you know, babysitting a 9-year-old neighbor. So it has to be broad enough, but also narrow enough that we don't have a ban on incidental contact. We don't have a problem if this court would prefer that probation spell that out in the condition, or the judge spell that out in the condition in terms of not banning incidental conduct. The rest of it's going back anyway.
Preposterous about this. So this is a 20-year-old offense, and his punishment for the offense was nominal?
Yes.
And yet it brings in its train a lifetime of expensive monitoring.
Right, and the lifetime portion of it is because the judge misunderstood the advisory guidelines.
So how long
was
it
imposed? Lifetime.
SORNA is a lifetime obligation,
right.
So Judge Posner's right. It's a lifetime if he complies with SORNA of every time he goes on a vacation to another state for more than a tiny period of time. Every time he does anything, he registers with the police.
Right.
The rest of us don't have to do that.
Right. That's true. But I was speaking, Judge Posner, to your point about it being a lifetime term of supervised release here, and we concede that is not appropriate in this case and that the judge misunderstood the advisory guideline as being recommended lifetime supervised release when really it's a point of 5 years in terms of the advisory guidelines range. So, you know, it's...
Why is the U.S. attorney defending this, like number five? Why do you want to have this? What's the point
of
it?
The no-contact provision?
Is this
a
real menace in your district for all these people who committed sex offenses 20 years ago?
Well, I can tell you that when
half the population, probably.
There was a lot of discussion in our office about these conditions, and my view was it was important to go to the people who prosecute these kinds of offenses, because I don't, and to see from them which ones do you care about and which ones, you know, are clearly overbroad in this case.
You don't know what the offense was, right?
Well,
it's all incredibly murky as to what actually happened 20 years ago.
I think that's fair. We have information, you know, in the PSR about what the father said and what the boy corroborated, but we don't know exactly what happened. I mean, that was a 2 year after the fact.
Like, you know, it's expensive and it kind of ruins a person's life to be subjected to all this stuff.
I don't think that we're far apart on this. I really don't. I mean, we've confessed error on the three and on the range of supervised release, and we think that under a plain error standard that there is information in the record sufficient to support the no contact provision. I see that my time has expired. Thank you very much,
Ms. Muller. Mr. Hansmeier, you have anything further? No? Okay, well, we thank the defenders for representing Mr. Goodwin, and the court will be under. Certainly thank you. Ms. Mullen as well.